AutoLine After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, passion for excellence.
This podcast was recorded live during the Racing in America event at the Henry Ford Museum in Dearborn, Michigan. You'll find two shows in your podcast feed this week, and this one is for you newsaholics out there. I sat around the table with Peter and David as music and partying continued in the background, and we were talking about Chevy, the Panos Abruzzi, Ford's restoration parts, and more. So sit back and enjoy this special event from the Henry Ford. This is AutoLine After Hours with John McElroy, Episode 59, Part 2, for Thursday, June 10th, 2010. Chevy. Watch AutoLine After Hours live at AutoLineDetroit.tv every Thursday at 7 p.m. Eastern Time or 2300 hours GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for AutoLine After Hours in the iTunes Store.
Well, that was cool. I mean, cool. I especially liked Leonard Wood. I mean, I don't know why. The guy just, he's the quintessential Southern gentleman. I really like that.
I was kind of taken aback that the Wood guy, I know they read me in NASCARville.
Yes, they do. Yeah. Yes, they do, Peter. Unbelievable.
I'd like to spend some more time. I seem like a cool dude.
I do need to go over. I need to check out the presidential limo.
Yeah. Hello, everybody.
Now we're back to more of a little bit more normal after hours. But some really important developments this week, this morning especially, and I'm talking about Chevy, not Chevrolet, or Chevrolet, not Chevy. And
Let me give some background to the viewers out there. Internally within GM, now that they've gone to four divisions, there's a massive push for the Chevrolet brand globally, and this has been going on for a few years now.
Sure.
They made the mistake of making the pronouncement that, well, globally, no one understands Chevy, it's Chevrolet, so we might as well be consistent. That's fine. Mm-hmm. But you don't blow up the United States part of the vernacular and, you know, since subsequently today, they backed way off of it.
Right.
But I'm going to throw this out because I put it on the site. Joe Lewanek, the new head of GM marketing.
Like surprises.
I've dubbed him now the maestro of buzz. What is GM working on right now? They're working on an all-new ad campaign for Chevrolet. Has Chevrolet been on the radar screen out there in any way, shape, or form other than the ads? No. How do you get on the radar screen? What is everybody every media outlet in the country talking about today? Chevrolet. So I would not be surprised if there's a little bit of that. And who leaked it to the New York Times? Or said, well, someone leaked it. Oh, really?
Yeah.
We've been in this business. They've got controlled leaks all the time. So I'm just going to throw that out.
Well, some of the PR people I talked to were surprised about the whole thing.
Surprised in what way?
The reaction.
Yeah, the reaction to it.
Are they tone deaf?
Well, what they were saying, this is their explanation anyway, is that they just want to stick to Chevrolet in the international markets. They know.
I understand.
Yeah, we get that.
Right.
Yeah. Don't, you know, put it out in the.
Well, not only that.
Well, they didn't put it out. Well, I don't know that they actually leaked it. I saw this as internal silliness. I mean,
right.
It's like.
Well, it is internal silliness, no question.
It is. It's one of these. It's like, you know, I went to University of Pittsburgh, which has been Pitt for like two centuries or something, right? I mean, the school was founded in 1787. A few years ago, they said, we're not Pitt, we're Pittsburgh, and now Pittsburgh is on the jerseys. So all of us who went there, you know, 15, 20 years ago are just going to start saying, yeah, I went to Pittsburgh. It just doesn't work that way.
No.
You just don't
right.
stop saying Chevy, and they know that. Now, why they, I mean, what drove me nuts about this is one of these things that companies waste time on internally. If Chevy customers in Bulgaria want to call it Chevy or Chevrolet or Chewy or whatever, let them do it if they like the cars and they come back and buy the brand. I mean, why do you, let the customers own the brand in you know, whatever way they want to, as long as it's good business.
I totally agree. But
and I hear what you're saying about Iwanik, but I'm not sure I'm...
This doesn't sound like a controlled leak to me because they look silly.
Well, that's the thing. No question. The buzz is all about them. But so many people, like myself, are saying, what boneheads? And they don't need that kind of buzz.
No, they don't. But since this is a NASCAR weekend, we can't forget... Can't forget the third pronunciation, Chevrolet.
Yeah,
my Chevrolet. My Chevrolet run real good today.
Or Chevy. Yeah. Lloyd Royce always pronounced it Chevy, and there were a number of other people at GM that always called it Chevy or Chevrolet.
Yeah, C-H-I-V.
Yeah, right.
It's all right. So it's. I think people need to. It'll be over with. You know, it was good for this morning.
It gave us something to write about.
A lot of hand wringing, and I got so many emails. I just you know. I had to put something on the site because everyone was writing. It was just like, look,
you had to go for it.
I think it'll blow over. It's okay. It's okay.
What'd you guys make of the GM management changes, though, where Lochner was put in charge of a new ventures company, and that's all they announced. That's the only thing they went public with. And then there were other seismic changes that did not get.
Should we shed light on a little inside baseball? Maybe not. Mark Rice wrote me and said, what's McElroy? Tell McElroy. John goes on his show online daily and says, you know, I forget what he said. But he was like, what aren't they telling us, you know?
Yeah, well, I said, they're hiding this from us. Yeah. Why? Why are they hiding it from us?
Mark Rice writes me, tell McElroy.
He saw Royce's moves. I, you know, what I'm gathering is that, you know, Lochner is good for the job as far as hunting down new technologies and stuff like that, because he was one of the original guys in the Volt. I've been talking to him.
I'm not sure it's Mark Royce's moves, not entirely.
I think the planning part is. I think he wanted somebody in planning.
But why is...
planning reporting to Whitaker.
Why is it reporting to Whitaker? Exactly.
That's what I think Big Ed wasn't happy with some of the planning decisions.
But here you've got Tom Stevens. Design reports to him, engineering reports to him, product development reports to him.
Basically inherited Lutz's job.
And now here's the guy who's got to plan out all the cars that he's got to do, but he doesn't report to Stevens. He reports to the chairman who has zip product experience. I mean, none whatsoever. And that's where I said, that's where it makes my blood run cold, is I don't get it. And of course, there's no explanation and no release. And that's when I say, when a major corporation make some fairly significant changes and doesn't put out a release on it, we in the media should sit up and pay attention because there's a story behind it.
Mark, you want to talk to John again?
Well, look, product planning is, I think it's been a problem at GM for a number of years.
Oh, yeah.
And
I don't know. I think Lutz has got it pretty much straightened out, or had it straightened out.
Bob has product execution straightened out.
The pioneers, the modern pioneers of good product planning at GM was John Smith when they started Reinvent Cadillac. Mm-hmm. That was the first time they showed that we got a plan.
But you might have something there. Elaborate on that lack of planning. Saying that Lutz was good at execution, but maybe not the planning.
I think the whole planning group, and I'm not blaming it all on Bob, the whole system, I think, was sort of broken down. They were late to so many things. They were late to rear drive and luxury cars. They were late with crossovers. Technically, they weren't late because the Aztec was first. But then once that failed, having the Buick Enclave and all of that vehicle, that was brainstormed back in '96. They never got it to market. They were late with not the current Equinox, but the other one, and they didn't put enough emphasis on it. And, you know, a lot of other cars, like, you know, why is the Impala gone this long without a refresh? I mean, these are
because it's a fleet car.
But these are decisions made either by or with a lot of input from the planning group. And, yeah, I think the execution has been really good, but they just haven't hit market segments early. What do they hit early? What does GM jump out on that beats everybody to market?
Well, let's not forget, on the dearly departed Aztec, it was the forerunner of the modern crossover, that type of vehicle. That package invented that segment.
Right. That's when they had planning good and execution.
Yeah.
Not so
good. The RX300 first? I thought the Japanese did it first because they wanted SUVs, but they didn't have truck platforms.
The RX300 was the first one out there. But
the Aztec was the first one intended for the mass market.
Correct.
And if they had not made such a bollocks of it, they, they would have hit the ball out of the park.
Why does it feel like it's suddenly 2:30 in the morning? Yeah.
With this band in the background.
Yeah, I was just like,
I think planning's been an issue over there. A lot of the guys in product development tell me that.
And thanks again, guys. Thank you. I want to come down and see your shop sometime.
Take that.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. I want to come down and see your shop sometime. Okay. Damn.
What is it? Hold it up.
60th anniversary of the Wood Brothers. Now that is
number 21.
Special. That is special.
Cool.
Wow. That's really cool.
And to have one of the Wood Brothers give it to you makes it even more
damn.
So.
Damn.
I'll tell you, one thing Whitaker hates is indecisiveness. I'm not saying they were indecisive, but my guess is here that if he has planning reporting straight to him, they weren't acting quick enough, they weren't making decisions on products, and he just decided, okay, we're going to get somebody new in there, and he's going to ride herd on it and make sure they're deciding. That doesn't mean he's going to make the product decisions. At least I hope he doesn't, because
no,
he's
no,
not
he
a
won't.
Car guy.
No, that's right. But all I'm saying is, what a signal to Tom Stevens that you don't trust him. I mean, to me, that's
Stevens
what I'm reading
never,
into it.
Stevens has never done planning. He's a powertrain guy before this. Now he's running product. He's not a planning guy either.
Right, but...
Neither is Ed Welber.
No, that's right. But, you know, you would think that since they're the ones who have to design and develop those products, you know, this guy would report into them.
So who is the new planning guy again?
Steve Carlisle.
Right.
Who had been...
Sales,
right.
So... That actually, I don't know enough about Carlisle himself, but putting someone who actually sells the cars to the public in the planning area.
No, that's a good move. I think that's a good move.
If he's a guy that they think knows what the public wants and will want.
I just see a real disconnect between him having Carlisle report to Whitaker and not to Stevens. And when I start to see this bifurcation of, oh, I don't trust you to run that, so I'm going to have him report to me, I go, oh, man, it's not a good management structure, or it's not a good management dynamic between these people.
The open question is, how much input will the engineering guys have in planning? They have to have a lot, because you're talking about platforms and engines that make these cars.
Right.
And that's what they're going to have to work out with this structure, and make sure that those guys...
Well, maybe they should reinvent Fisher Body, because that's exactly how it was handled way back when.
That's way back when they went to the GM assembly division.
GMAD.
That was a lot of people think that's where GM started to really go off the rails, right when they did
the 1984 reorganization. Yeah. It's been downhill ever since.
I think GMAD was even before 84.
It was. Oh yeah, no, GMAD started in the 60s. Exactly.
Under Frederick Donner, wasn't it?
You could be right. I don't know that for a fact.
Fred Donner was the 60s. He used to call my house. Fred Donner?
No, Jed.
Oh, yeah. He'd call and say, Dale Earnshaw's over there?
Yeah.
I said, what?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I'm here.
And I give him the phone to my dad, and after he'd talk, I said, who was that? He said, that was Fred
Donner. The big
Donner.
Boss.
Yeah. I said, really?
I've talked to automotive historians who think that he was the beginning of the decline for GM.
Oh,
he was a finance guy. He was the first finance guy to run the company. I believe he groomed Roger Smith.
Wouldn't surprise me. They all came out of the New York Treasurer's office, as you know.
Started that long history, which was basically broken when Ed Whitaker became CEO.
Actually, it was broken
With Stemple.
With Stemple and Royce, right.
Fred wasn't well liked. Let's put it that way. Fred wasn't well liked by very many people.
Well, you know, GMAD, I believe, was started. I've never heard anybody ever verify this, but my theory is, there was a U.S. senator from Michigan called Phil Hart who tried to break up General Motors, saying then, and this was true in the 60s, it was a monopoly. You know, GM was just under 50% market share, and he tried to break Chevrolet off of General Motors. And this is about the time when GM created GMAD, and I think it was done to say, you can't break Chevrolet off because it's so intertwined with General Motors. It's basically no longer a standalone company.
Yeah, under Sloan, it was a series of companies sort of managed by one guy at the top with a lot of independence and autonomy. Mm-hmm. So it's like a bunch of eggs in a carton. And they figured if they scrambled it into an omelet, the Treasury Department couldn't take out one or two eggs. They had to leave the whole thing in there. I believe that was a reaction to it, but you know, Donner was the first of the finance guys, and that's when the car guys left the company. By the way, GMAD also, they had reorganized engineering in ways that just sent a lot of the expertise for body engineering and quality hither and yon, and suddenly nobody knew where anybody was anymore to get anything done, and it really hurt them.
Yeah.
That's when, because the quality problems for GM, everyone says, oh, it was the 80s when you had, like, you know, Chevettes and stuff. They actually started having quality problems in the 60s. And in the 70s, I was talking to this one dealer in Dallas who told me that late 70s is when GM dealers started moving. Remember, the service department used to be in the showroom. And they moved it away from the showroom because they didn't want potential customers listening to some guy at the counter screaming over the service problems.
I think it's time we have Mark Rice back on.
Let's get him back on.
Yeah.
Hey, another thing that came out this week, this Painaz Abruzzi Spirit of Le Mans car. I thought it was pretty cool.
I didn't see it.
Oh, man, it's like the Batmobile, but you can buy it, or will be able to buy it.
In Europe only.
In Europe only. I know, that's kind
of
weird.
And 81 of them to correspond with the number of times the 24-hour Le Mans has run.
By the time this car comes out.
And it'll be delivered at Le Mans.
Right.
Serviced at Le Mans, so it basically...
It truly is the spirit of Le Mans.
Yeah. And they're going to run it apparently in GT2.
Right. So you can buy it and race it.
But you can't buy it on the street here.
Correct.
But they're new competition versions.
I got to believe that's got to do with our safety and emission standards.
Oh, it's exactly. That's why they chose not to sell it here, because they didn't want to go through all that.
But you got to see this thing. It's all over online. You can get it. But
it's on Auto Extremist.
I'm not sure from... Yeah, it is on Auto Extremist. I'm not sure if from the front three quarters I like it a lot. It almost seems like the front fender
seam. But the back three quarters is nice.
And overhead and back three quarter looks... It's really cool.
And race form, I have a big-ass wing on it.
Which will ruin it.
Yeah.
So the other stories this week, we got Opel finally getting no aid. John was right.
I was right, but you were right, too, in the sense that I think they're going to get aid from the different states in Germany, local aid.
I think they already have from the state where Bochum is, where that
planet. Well, they're halfway there, right. Bochum's one of them, right. And they're halfway there in terms of what the states are supposed to put
up. Poland gave them a little bit of money, and then Spain and the UK have given them money.
Right, and I was just reading, I don't know if you guys reported it at Bloomberg, if it's likely where I read it, but... Now Opel is being told maybe if it applies for all these research and development credits for green vehicles, they can get a bunch of money that way. So the finance guys can just take one line item and move it over there, and you got the money that you need to do this thing.
The bottom line is, though, if they don't get all the money they need from Germany, I think you will see them not made like... a massive shifting away from Germany.
Slowly but surely.
They could add shifts in Poland, Spain, and the UK and downsize, and they'd probably downsize in Eisenach of the three plants that they have.
Right.
You could see that going on. Another interesting story this week that didn't get a lot of play, but I find it fascinating, is Honda's labor problems in China.
China. Right.
They settled a strike by giving workers like a 24% pay increase.
This is the beginning of the end for the whatever.
Yeah, I did a blog item on this that's up on the site. Talking to Sean McElinden at the Center for Automotive Research, and he said that Chinese auto wages are now matching Mexico.
Yeah,
so it's all over, man. Let's go to Mexico.
Yeah, because it's $1,200 to $2,000 per car to ship it across the Pacific. So, and he told me, too, that some of the Japanese automakers are telling their parts companies to source not in Asia, but in Mexico. Mexico has free trade agreements, no tariffs with 25 countries. So you can build whatever you want there. Bring the stuff in without tariffs, ship it out South America, the U.S., Europe without, you know.
Hey, why do you think Ford's putting the Fiesta in Mexico? Why do you think Chrysler's putting the Fiat 500 in Mexico for exactly those reasons?
So cheaper labor, great agreements, and it's, you know, you're railing it up or trucking it up to the U.S. It's easier access to the market than
Well,
Asia.
As a North American, I'd rather see stuff in Mexico than in China.
I would, too. How about the RIT? Going on to the Washington Post board.
Well, for a guy that didn't love media,
to end up on the board of a media company.
Now he's
great point.
He's probably going to push a bunch of restructuring to fire a bunch of journalists. No, I'm kidding.
And so what? He was just invited on the board of directors for
Washington Post company. Give him something to do. I know he's back in town.
That's what these guys, you know, these guys do. They get on boards and, you know, they're advisors.
Well, he's from Virginia anyway, right? Which is borderline Washington. So I imagine there's some sort of connection there.
He wasn't bad with the media. He just, but he didn't really love it either. It wasn't his.
No, because everybody was pounding him for how come GM keeps losing market share and money. Yep.
It might get all that bought.
Yeah, I guess that would wear you down a wee bit.
Another story I liked, and I know you picked it up on your website too, was these Ford genuine restoration parts that go back to like 1909.
Oh,
and they're
cool.
Building old car parts that Ford sells on their website.
That's awesome.
And they just using original tooling. And if they don't have the original toolings, they've got the original blueprints, so they can check everything to the blueprint.
And they just, wow. the old, perfect, cool Bronco, the first one.
Right, right.
It'll be their fifth complete body that they're making that you can buy.
So, yeah, you can literally build a vintage car from all these
That's
restoration
fantastic.
Parts.
I mean, I think, you know, if I was Ford, I'd go back to that size Bronco.
Yes.
Put a turbo diesel modern drivetrain in it.
Right.
Reimagine that. That would be so cool.
Right.
Because the size of that thing was really cool.
Hey, another thing I'd like to talk about is I moderated a transmission conference in Ann Arbor.
Well, that's nice.
John,
I know.
John, you get all the best gigs, man. I got to tell you.
I'm test driving the new Regal this morning, and you're at a transmission
conference. And I'm at a transmission conference. But here's one thing that I picked up that I thought was very interesting.
They did a whole dissertation on torque converters.
Absolutely. I'm not exaggerating. And so what was interesting is their debate of will Americans really accept dual-clutch transmissions? Because in that first 10 feet of launch, and that's what the whole focus was on, can DCT match the launch expectations of American drivers? You get a little bit of a hesitation. There's a lag. And then, boom, once you're rolling, no problem. The thing rates great.
I think
great.
They will. I mean, you drive a GTI, and it's just like, yeah.
It's great.
Yeah.
But that was their point. If you're talking midsize and smaller, no problem. DCT is going to take over the world. But they said, you got you an SUV, and you want to haul your boat up the ramp? You want a torque converter. You got a full-size pickup? You want a torque converter. And it's interesting because, you know, sometimes the way I drive cars, I'll just adapt to the car. And it's like, okay, there's a hesitation, whatever. I don't care. And I've noticed this before in DCTs, and I never even picked up or wrote about it because it was just, I'll adapt. But I'll adapt. Will other people adapt? And like I said, you know, midsize or smaller, no problem. Like they said, they'll take over the world. And the fuel economy improvement is just, you're talking 10%. You can't ignore that as an automaker.
You know what I've noticed? Jeff Green and I were talking about this. He's the bureau chief for Bloomberg. The cars we've test driven lately, a lot of these 5 and 6 speed transmissions, when you get in the 35 to 40 mile per hour range, you get a lot of...
They hunt.
Yeah.
Right.
There's a whole committee in the gearbox, and they're arguing like hell to find out which gear you ought to go to. And it actually slows you down in some cases.
Yeah, well, I don't think I'm going to be getting any more Nissans to drive after I wrote about the Maxima I had, which had the four-door sports car, front-wheel drive with a CVT.
Wait, just say that. Four-door, front-wheel drive, CVT. That does not equal sports car.
No. And they saddle that beautiful engine with that...
3.5 liter?
Yeah. It was just bad.
Going back to my transmission conference experience here, that's what I was asking about.
You're killing me, man.
Well, I know. Hey, I thought the DCT thing was a little bit of good insight. So I asked him about whatever happened to CVTs, continuously variable transmissions. Why didn't they ever catch
really
on?
Work.
No, Nissan's actually done a pretty good job with them. But they said the problem with the CVT is it's the worst
only one that's really
the only one. And that's actually a JATCO, Japanese Automatic Transmission Company, transmission. But it's also got to do with the software controls of it. Because Chrysler used the same JATCO transmissions, and man, it didn't feel the same. But it was interesting, they said a CVT is the least efficient transmission in terms of converting mechanical efficiency. So I said, okay, so why would anybody ever go that way? And they said, it's because you can run the engine in a very narrow RPM range. So you get the engine in its sweet spot, at where it's most efficient. So even though the transmission is the least efficient, you put the engine in its most efficient mode, and that's why the thing works.
Well, it's one thing to have one in a Nissan Cube. You know, it's fine. You know, you
small,
you
light,
feel like
weight.
A Cube is kind of neat, but it can't get out of its own way.
Well, yeah, but it doesn't bother you. But when you get into something like the Maxima, that's allegedly a performance sedan, it's just a huge disconnect.
Right.
It just doesn't work.
No, it doesn't.
So no more great insights.
Oh, I'm not going to tell you any more in the transmission story.
Worked.
Screw you, man.
It worked.
Where was it? In Ann Arbor?
In Ann Arbor. I mean, these days, you know, you'd think.
So wait, you guys didn't test the new Regal today then? Oh, you're out in Ann Arbor.
No, Craig Cole from our staff
was out
there.
That's right, I did see him up there.
Yeah.
That's right.
No, I didn't.
What did he say about it?
I haven't talked to him. I'll know tomorrow morning.
What
I
thought it was.
It's a pretty good car. The turbo drives pretty nicely. There's one thing in it, and I told the guys too, and they were very disappointed. But the interior is generally very nice, except what I think is the most important part, which is the whole center stack with all the environmental controls and everything like that. There's this plastic they have on there that looks like it's from the GM cars from like 8 years ago. It's just this flat, bland plastic. And I've been in the Cruise, which has a dynamite
interior. That's interesting
interior,
because they
and
had
I just,
me.
I looked at it, and you know, as auto writers, we sound like we're nitpicking when we're complaining about this one piece of, but it's the piece you look at and touch all the time, and it just looks really Spartan and cheap and it doesn't feel cheap. It's not bad. It just, like the whole rest of it with the, you know, the wood they have in there looks nice, and like this doesn't even match. It's sort of like one of these things where someone could chop $35 a car out of it or something, and it's just.
Disappointed to hear that because.
I was left cold by it. It's just one of these things that jumps out at you because you're driving.
Yep.
You look at the windshield, you look at that, and you look in the mirrors.
Well,
and
I'll
you're
tell
only
you.
Have 3 points in the car the whole time.
Another reason I'm disappointed is last year they had a number of us in to look at the car at the time. I said the same thing as like, man, that just looks too cheap. And they said, oh, don't worry. When it gets to production here, we've got that fixed. So it doesn't sound like they did.
No, and the weird thing is this is a mid-sized car that's going to be priced, I think they said like from 25 to 29. There might be a base model coming that's cheaper than that. And you got a Cruise that starts at 17, 18. And you know, when I didn't get to drive it, but they let us ride in the Cruise.
You were saying you love the interior on the Cruise. Right. But it's the latest thing, and you're right. Remember, this is an Opel product that actually goes back a couple of years ago. So it's the old GM, even though it's Opel. It's, you know, nickel and dime them to death.
How tough is it to fix that? I mean, and all it really is the one piece that frames all the buttons and the knobs and the screen. Mm-hmm. How tough is it to tell your supplier, upgrade it, put some kind of cool texture or gloss or whatever you need, and slap it in there? It's probably, it was really disappointing.
Yeah, that's too bad to hear.
Okay, so
I'd say this is going to be the rapid fire part of the show.
We might as well just go for it right now.
Just go for it right now. This is pretty good. Google's Pisano says, when he saw or listened to us talking about those four genuine restoration parts, he says, when can I build my own 1978 Fairmont? The origami card.
That's I was hoping for a 93 Mercury Tracer.
Dan wants to know, what do you think of the announcement of a large rear-wheel drive car for Cadillac? We've talked about that a lot. Yeah, it's coming.
Yeah.
What's that called? XTS? Or is that the small one?
No, the ATS is the small one.
XTS
is what they showed in Detroit.
Right.
Yeah. It's actually, I think, all-wheel drive because it's based off Epsilon 2, which
absolutely
is a front-drive
right.
platform.
Ford guy says, GM was a monopoly? What about the other two, Ford and Chrysler? You're right. Technically, it was an oligopoly, not a monopoly.
It was an oligopoly dominated by one major player.
Correct.
It was not a monopoly, but his point's well taken, though a bit pedantic.
Unsprung wants to know, is the band the exhaust notes?
No.
No.
Oh, you mean the exhaust tones? No. Yeah.
Mud Monster wants to know if they can play Stairway to Heaven.
They probably can.
Like a Pat Boone kind of thing? When he played heavy metal tunes to...
when he dressed in leather? Yeah, awesome, man.
George from Brooklyn wants to know, Autoblog posted a rumor last week that Chris Bangle may return to auto design at Fiat. Any truth to this?
Got me.
I haven't heard of that, but God help them.
You're not a fan of Chris?
No, I think he's a talented guy, but if I'm going to go with the designer, I'll go with the Freeman Thomas.
Freeman?
Look, he's a good designer. I don't think design is Fiat's problem.
Correct.
They make good-looking cars, especially the Alphas.
Yeah, especially the Alphas.
Sergio insists they're going to sell 65,000 in Alphas by 2014.
Well, I said they're going to sell 160,000 Grand Cherokees.
Yeah.
We can all say whatever. Okay. What can GM, Ford, and Chrysler learn from the rise of Hyundai?
Focus, dedication, relentless will to succeed. Don't ever take your eye off the ball. It adds up.
Well, Ford's already earned it to a degree. Quality.
Yeah, Ford is...
Quality. That's what's pushing Hyundai.
Yeah.
Quality, good design. You're right about simplicity, because you look at Hyundai's line, car in every segment for that purpose. You don't have, you know, a lot of kind of crossover stuff. And I don't mean crossover SUVs. I mean, like, vehicles that sort of bump into each other. Like, you got a Malibu and an Impala. You got a Regal and a LaCrosse. You got a Fusion and a Taurus. I mean
GM is still bumping up against each other.
Yes, it is. Right.
I mean, you know.
Ford does a bit, too, because I think Fiesta's going to bump into Focus as well.
Well, you know, look, they're in a transition.
Yeah.
You know, you can't help it. You know, they started to change 3 years ago to do a different cadence. Yeah. And as you guys know, your platforms are out there for 8 years. Yeah.
Well, you make a good point, because Hyundai sort of started with a clean sheet in this market, and they're just adding products to lines.
But
it's easier to do that.
My observation is twofold. You can change your quality around real fast, and you can change your brand image around real fast. Everybody says, oh, it takes years to change this around. Hyundai didn't take very long.
Another thing, though, Hyundai has is lower labor costs and a government who manipulates the yuan.
I know, but still, they had that before and put out crappy-looking cars.
No, they've gotten it together, they've got some advantages.
They do have advantages, but, you know, it still comes down to coming out with pretty cool cars.
Mm-hmm.
So, let's see. VRM Chris says, what are the steps that you believe NASCAR needs to do to stay relevant and possibly move forward and improve?
Well, I've covered this many times, but
let's get his drum and something to beat it with.
Yeah. But, you know, I think they really need to go to Mustang, Camaro, and Challenger. But
we should have asked Nate that question.
Yeah. Well, I've talked to Nate many times about it, but stock dimension bodyworks, modern fuel injected engines, alternative fuel. But the key thing is stock dimension bodyworks. Go back to the old way where you had a front air dam and a rear spoiler, and all the manufacturers lobbied in tech inspection for their little tweaks. We need another eighth of an inch this week.
Right.
I don't know.
Right, right.
And, you know, and just because the hardcore NASCAR fan needs to have a visual connection with the product on the track, and they don't have it now.
I think they would bring in more fans.
I would watch it.
What I think of NASCAR? I mean, I think it's, I watch women's tennis before I watch NASCAR.
The bodies are more attractive.
But if they race Camaro, Mustang, and Challenger, I'd watch it.
Yeah, absolutely. Cool. Absolutely.
Because I love going to Laguna Seca and watching the vintage
pony car racer.
That's my favorite event at Laguna Seca.
It would bring fans back, and I cannot understand why NASCAR, they just don't have the vision. They just don't have, you know, it's staring them right in the face. You've got three players right there. And figure out what Toyota can run. They'll figure something
and
out.
And because I got to say this, because I know that we've got students out there that are involved in racing programs, we absolutely are saying keep all of the car of tomorrow safety features and everything.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Just put a different body on the whole thing.
All that safety stuff will fit in those bodies.
Right, exactly right. Michelle Naranjo says, is Ike upset that he was left out of tonight's show? Yes, he was.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm telling you, he wanted to be here tonight. He's bummed. Let's see. Steve Dargell says, how long before Ford abandons Lincoln, just like all the other luxury brands not going to happen.
No, they are going all in on Lincoln, believe me.
Let's see here. Fast Joe wants to know, when's Ford going to build an all-wheel drive Mustang to go up against Audi in the Northeast? I don't think an all-wheel drive Mustang will ever happen.
It'll never happen.
It's not a pony car. Another kind of high-performance all-wheel drive Ford would make sense.
Well, you will see a high-performance Focus down the road with all-wheel drive and serious horsepower.
What about a Taurus Show with all-wheel drive?
Well, that's a bigger car. I mean, yeah, you got that now, but you will see a high-performance Fiesta and a high-performance Focus.
But he's talking about something that's exclusively a sports car as opposed to a performance version of every man's car. I know what he's saying, but it's not. John's right. It's not a pony car.
Not going to happen.com.
Bingo. Car Average Joe says, how do people feel about building a Lincoln sedan on the Mustang platform? I don't know if anyone's even contemplating anything like that.
Yeah, well, yeah.
Well, I mean, if you say something
What's it going to be? I mean, I guess you could have some kind of cool two-door. It depends what you mean by the platform, too. I mean, they can heavily modify platforms. I mean, I guess you could do a cool two-door Continental off a Mustang platform.
Well, you could do a Mark 10.
That's what I'm talking about, some kind of Mark.
That would be cool.
Yeah.
Lincoln definitely needs to expand its
lineup. Remember, wasn't the last Continental was a two-door, wasn't it? The last one before they got rid of it in the 90s?
The Mark 8 was a two-door, right. No, they've done that sort of stuff in the past and been pretty good at it. Let's see here. Boy, some of these questions are long. It's hard to read through all of them. Jim Campbell wants to know, so who builds H1 Hummers now? Is AM General still around? That's a good question. I don't know. I mean...
Well, GM stopped involving themselves with the H1 long
right.
time
so
ago.
The Hummer name is gone. But the Hummer V, built by AM General. But I don't know if they're building civilian versions.
No, they're not. The civilian version has been gone for a while.
Okay.
No one's building it. I guess someone could buy the name and do that again. I don't even know who owns the Hummer name anymore. I guess GM would still own it. I wish I had the money.
I keep telling you, I would love
Peter,
to have
I'm totally with you. I think.
But you'd have to make it into a super exclusive, very low volume SUV brand. I think it's got to be like the Lamborghini of SUVs.
Well, you could do a lot of things. You could do that on the high end, and you could do somehow scrape the money to do the H4.
Do the H4, drop a diesel in it.
But even the H4 is going to be kind of a toy type vehicle.
Well, yeah, but
for SUV and sand dune hoppers and off roaders.
I know,
it's
but
cool.
You know, I think actually Hummer could have maybe a better chance of really making money more than Saab does.
Probably could. Saab sold 40,000 cars globally last year.
Right. And so, I mean, if Hummer sold 40,000 at the prices they were commanding, it'd be a whole lot better off than Saab.
The new 9.5 is a great-looking car, and I hear it drives really well. The issue it's going to have is they want to charge a lot more money for this than the outgoing 9.5. Now, the outgoing 9.5, literally, my favorite expression, old enough to shave, it's 13 years old. It is literally old enough to shave. So you're not going to get any real pricing on that, but they're looking for like over 50,000 for this, and if you can get into an A6 or a 5 Series for that kind of money, or why would you buy a Saab unless you're one of the Saabista and you really got to have it? It's a tough one. I mean, I think the guys who bought it understand what Saab is and ought to be, and I think GM left them with some good product, ironically, just as they were abandoning the brand. But making enough, getting the price you need and the volume at the same time, it's like the GM guys have always told me, the trouble with Saab is if you make the Saabs that Saab lovers want, you don't get the volume. If you reach out for more volume,
you lose the Saab lovers.
You lose the Saab lovers, and they're wasn't enough there to bring in the rest of the public, and they just could never make it work.
Although the new 9.5 looks really terrific, and now the reviews are starting to come in. They just had the long lead for that.
It's very distinctive.
It's positive so far, the feedback.
And it is a real Saab. It's got the curved windshield. It's got push-button start between the seats.
Yeah, it's weird enough to be a Saab.
It is.
But cool.
Right. Well, probably the credit goes to Ed Welburn.
Yeah.
Seriously,
yeah.
It probably goes to Ed Welburn to say,
look. When Brian Nesbitt was running GM Europe Design.
Okay, but I mean, still, you got to have the guy at the top to say, yeah, bingo, push it. It's got to be a Saab, not something that satisfies finance and purchasing.
Yeah.
Okay, here's a good question from Don Hipp. He says, why do car companies continue to put tax in all cars? Well, it's not all. I just asked my wife if she knew what a tack was. Her answer is, I don't know. He says, I'd be willing to bet 80% of people don't know what they are or care to pay for them. Good point. I like to have a tack in a car, but, you know, in the U.S., what, 95% of all cars are automatics. I'm not sure you need an automatic or
Well, the good thing is
you got to have a tack in the car.
It's part of the full instrumentation package. You know, we remember when you had to order a tack. And if you didn't order a tack, the IP would look really bad. So they got away from that. We just got to have a tack because if they start eliminating tacks, then, wow, hell freezes over.
You got to have a tech because people want to watch a red line. People like to drive.
Well, I mean, most people don't even know what a red line is, but you got to have a tech.
I don't know about that.
If you pull the tech, it's the beginning of the end.
Well, I think we're at the end here of questions.
And, we are.
Well, I mean, there's stuff, but some of these actually go back to prior shows.
The lengthy questions, yeah. You got to cut your questions down.
It's hard to just skim through here without having long dead spots as I try to read a long question.
We can blab on for a long time. We can argue about whether or not people know tax or not. I think enough people, it's sort of a... It's a real navel-gazing issue here.
I mean, I like having a tack because I like knowing what the engine's doing. And in the wintertime, I like using compression braking. So I like, you know, downshifting even with an automatic, and I like to know where the tack is, et cetera, et cetera. And in fact, what was I in just recently? The BMW GT, and at 80 miles...
The 5GT?
The 5GT, right.
It's a damn good-looking car.
No, it's not, but it's a damn good driving one.
I like it.
Well, okay.
David's ultimate two-car garage. The green, what's the green called?
The Synergy Green
Synergy
Camaro.
Synergy Green Camaro and the 5GT.
Right? I got a picture of it, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, he's got it right on his phone.
But I got one without all the stuff. Maybe they can see it.
You don't
in
like
here.
The stripes?
No. I mean, I've got one that's just...
Stuff on a screen.
Here we go.
Yeah.
The Synergy Green Camaro.
But anyway, at 80 miles an hour, the BMW GT was barely turning 2,000 RPM. And I like knowing that kind of stuff.
Is that a 7-speed? Or?
I don't know for a fact. So it's got to be a 7 or an 8 because that's the benchmark these days. Although, that was another piece of news. We see that Chrysler is going to start building 8-speed transmissions in a couple of years. And... believe me, that's tooling up Kokomo to make them. So that transmission's going in a lot of vehicles, not just expensive ones.
Cool.
An 8-speed. Doesn't Mercedes have an 8-speed right now?
Yeah, 8-speed's the benchmark right now.
Or is it Lexus?
Right.
Lexus put it in the LS. I remember Jim Press saying at the press conference because Mercedes had the 7-speed in the S-Class, and yes, we've won up them.
Right. And what was that Chinese company, do you remember, that had the 8-speed? You don't remember. Anyway, some Chinese company has just developed an 8-speed transmission.
See, what I want is someone to have an 11-speed transmission so that they can say this one goes to 11.
Excellent.
But going back to my transmission conference, that's one of the other things they talked about. When the Chinese come here, they're all going to have 8-speeds, and it's going to force everybody to up their
game.
Even
better, if you engineer a sports car that redlined at 11,000 RPMs,
there you go.
Then you could say this one goes to 11. Or it could redline it more appropriately to the movie, Spinal Tap. You could have a car that really redlines at 7,000, and you could just write 11,000 on the tack and say this one goes to 11. One of my colleagues in Tokyo, Ian Rowley, with Bloomberg, has a question. He says, what do you think of the Honda CR-Z? Too much of a compromise or an interesting idea?
Well,
I was disappointed. The concept car was really cool, the white concept show car. But I thought the production execution from the A-pillar forward was a disappointment.
I'll drive it Monday, and I'll totally reserve my judgment until then. But my initial impressions are, don't really like the styling. I don't think it works. I think your criticism is absolutely right. Small car inside.
Needs more horsepower.
Kind of pricey. And the fuel economy is not blow-away fuel economy.
No,
you know, I would expect Honda to come down and say, oh, yeah, Toyota, look at this. And it's not that good.
Especially for a car that size. The front end, to me, looks like some of the... They're going to hate this but and I don't like Honda styling, as we've talked about before, mm-hmm. but the You've, front end of
to
it...
To quote David Welch, they've lost their mojo.
They've lost their mojo. The front end looks like some of the Chinese cars I've seen at auto shows 3 or 4 years ago when the Chinese companies first started coming out with some very awkward stuff. I've lost faith in Honda's ability to really execute something that's going to turn anybody's head. So, we'll see. I mean, the Honda files are a loyal bunch of those.
So who else?
Okay, then we had Greg Biffle here. And I got a chance to ask him about sliding through the turns, because I don't think that's something that people really realize in the NASCAR circuit, especially on the road courses, is how these guys are. I mean, they're like 10 tenths or maybe 10 and a half tenths almost every turn.
Well, on the road courses, it's almost more obvious to see, but I think the TV coverage, especially with HD, has improved. When you see them on a big track going through the corners, I mean, and they're sideways, right. Coming out of four, and they're... And you see them, they go in a corner, they're all... You know,
drifting.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
They're drifting. And, you know, again...
And people don't understand that that's how they go fast.
And, but to do that with cars all around you for hours on end, at the speeds they're doing, it's impressive.
I have all the respect in the world for the drivers, the crews, the people who work on these cars. My problem has always been with the NASCAR marketing machine. They always seem to get it wrong.
And the guys who run the whole racing
That's
circuit.
What I meant.
Yep. We had Robert Haight from John Force Racing. It was cool to
Robert
have him.
He's just, he loves what he does and is happy to be alive.
And then we had Leonard Wood, who I just loved meeting, because this guy...
Yeah, talking about Indy in 1965 when Ford drafted the Wood brothers to crew for Jimmy Clark and Colin Chapman when Clark won, and it's just like, wow.
And I didn't get a chance to ask it, but I remember reading at the time as a kid that Ford wanted them to go to Formula One racing, and they were like, for what?
Yeah.
For what? We're making more money in NASCAR than we could make in Formula One, which was true at the time.
Well, at the time, going up to Indy was about as far north as they cared to go.
How does anyone make money in Formula One with the expense of those teams and those cars?
Oh, people make money in Formula One.
Yeah, big money. Then we had John Force on as well. What a cool guy. What a totally...
Oh, he's a hoot.
John has been through hell. He was talking about he lost a guy who drove for him, was killed, and then that caused them to totally reconstruct how funny cars are built. And to Ford's credit, they put their best guys on it, and they engineered the safety cell for the funny cars.
Does Ford pretty much dominate the funny car?
Yeah, and then John, of course, had a terrible accident.
He said he broke his arms and legs.
Oh, yeah, he was in bad shape.
And but to see him here today, you would never know that.
Yeah, but he's back, and he's right.
But these guys got to be in pain. I mean, people are talking about NFL running backs creaking and walking around in pain for the rest of their life.
But this year, he's back on point, and he's doing real well, and his team is, like, super.
Well, remember what Robert Haight told us is out of the shot in a dragster, boom, five G slam. And then he says it tends to taper off, and then he says... You give it some more clutch, I think is what he said, and about halfway down the track, you get another 5G slam, and then you hit the end and pull the chute, and it's a 4G.
A negative 4G.
Wow. Which has been known to
separate retinas,
which is unreal. Then we had Christian Overland here from the Henry Ford talking all about, you know, what they're doing
here.
Because
this is 18 months away, the actual...
Well, as he said, they got to raise $15 million to be able to go build this exhibit.
That's a lot.
It's a lot. This place will pull it off.
Yeah.
They will pull it off. We had Bob Tasca III from Tasca Racing, also in drag racing.
That's another guy I missed that I wanted to talk about.
Interesting guy, yeah. I don't know him. I've never met him before. Didn't know him at all.
He's a dealer. But
he is a dealer. Right.
That's a true story. The grandfather came up with the saying, "Win on Sunday, sell on Monday."
That really?
Yeah.
That was his grandfather. That was him. I've talked to Bob Tasca III about for dealer issues. They're Ford Lincoln dealers.
He was good. I was impressed by him for not knowing him at all.
His grandfather came up with that.
Wow, cool.
Because they were huge into drag racing in the early 60s.
They're good dealers. They're pretty, I think they've got some pull within Ford, too.
Oh, well, they definitely do.
Then we had Von Gritten, who is the drifter guy.
Von Gitten Jr., yeah.
Yeah, that was that's pretty
awesome. I've seen him in action. He's having way too much fun.
I can't believe you can make a living as a professional drifter.
Well, we're talking the very top.
He's
of that.
The top,
yeah,
right? Yeah,
so
right.
He can, but mm-hmm. not very many below him can.
I didn't until tonight. I didn't know there was professional drifting.
Yeah.
I just thought it was something for bad movies. There's a bad movie about drifting. I think there might even be a couple unnecessary sequels to go along with it.
Fast and Furious. First Fast and Furious is actually pretty good. The second one stunk, and the latest one was okay. But, you know, it's worth it, you know. Hot babes, fast cars. I mean, it's formulaic, but it still works.
Formulaic. I love that. Then we had Jamie Allison, who runs Forig Racing.
Jamie was on with us literally within 2 weeks of when he first got the job.
Right, so. Right.
He's a good guy.
And that was an interesting conversation, too, about how much simulation, computer simulation, plays in setting up race cars before you even get to the track.
Yeah.
They literally run the race on the computer, and then they try to set the car up.
Part of the reason Hendrick Motorsports has been so successful, and this is real inside baseball stuff, is Pratt & Miller Engineering. Pratt & Miller is the one who, the company who prepares the Corvettes for ALMS, but Pratt & Miller has some of the finest proprietary computer tools that they design in the business, the envy of a lot of teams all over the world, including Formula One. And the direct beneficiary of Pratt & Miller is Hendrick Motorsports.
That's
exactly
right.
Why can't Ford get it right?
They're working on it.
They're working on it, but that's a good question, David. That's a really good question. Because, you know, Ford's got armies of programmers. I don't know if they still do. Do car companies still buy supercomputers, or is it all this network kind of stuff that they do these days?
Well, you went on a tour of Pratt Miller, and you walk by, and you see one of those stations there.
Oh, yeah. Very powerful workstations.
Yeah.
No, I was blown away by that operation.
That's the coolest, one of the coolest tours you can.
And it also ties in, remember, a couple of weeks ago, we had Sheila Ronis, you know, this defense industry expert. And there's a real crossover between military and racing.
Yeah.
It's and Pratt & Miller is working on a lot of military stuff, which is pretty wild. Then we had Nate Ryan from USA Today, who covers motorsports for them. And then Eddie and Len Woods, the Woods brothers, but the new generation.
Yeah. Yeah, and that was cool to see that. I know they read me, and he was a big reader.
No kidding. What a compliment, man.
Yeah, that was cool.
That is really cool for him to say, I've read you a lot, man. Well, real good.
It's been quite a show, actually.
This is kind of a cool thing.
Thanks for tuning in, everybody. It was good to see you again.
Yeah, good to be able to bring you to the Henry Ford Museum. And that wraps up this week's news analysis that we did. But don't forget, we also did a second podcast with all the different racing celebrities who showed up at the Henry Ford Museum. You might want to check that podcast out now. Visit our website, OuterLineDetroit.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 7 p.m. Eastern. Get your daily automotive news fix with OuterLine Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with OuterLine Detroit. That's all there, and much more, at AutolineDetroit.tv.
AutoLine After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, passion for excellence.